Unfortunately, when the Alaska Air National Guard pararescue team got to the aircraft, they discovered there were two folks deceased on it.
A fatal crash near McGrath. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 13th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, GCI President Ron Duncan talks about events leading to the plane crash that killed Ted Stevens and four others.
My wife saw a survivor wave, and she said, I gotta get on the ground.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
A plane crash near McGrath has claimed the lives of two people. Alaska National Guard rescuers reached the downed flight early this morning. Guard spokesman Major Guy Hayes says the crash site is about 37 miles northeast of McGrath.
It was spotted by another pilot flying an aircraft who spotted the crash site below him.
Hayes says the names of the victims are not being released at this time.
Unfortunately, when the Alaska Air National Guard pararescue team got to the aircraft, they discovered there were two folks deceased on it, and they had a dog with them as well, but the dog was found to still be alive.
Hayes says foul weather prevented rescuers from staying long enough to recover the bodies of the victims.
They weren't able to stick around the rescue site very long, but they had to hoist back up to the AH-60 PAVOC helicopter and fly back to McGrath, where they turned the dog over to Alaska State Troopers. And at this time, the accident investigation and recovery of the deceased air crew is being handled by the National Transportation Safety Board and the Alaska State Troopers.
The crash site is at the 2,000-foot level in the Sunshine Mountains. GCI President and CEO Ron Duncan spoke to APRN today about the Monday night crash that claimed the life of Senator Ted Stevens, GCI Senior Vice President Dana Tindall, Tindall's 16-year-old daughter Corey, William Phillips, and the pilot Terry Smith. Frequently fighting tears, Duncan said all those on board were close, longtime friends stretching back 30 years. Duncan said last Saturday, August 7th, the group had arrived at GCI's Agulawak retreat for 4 days of fishing. On the morning of the crash, pilot Terry Smith said there was too much turbulence and he felt they should wait for a while before heading to the fish camp. They had a late lunch and pilot Smith determined things had improved, so he took off with the 8 passengers for the Nooshagak River to fish for kings. Duncan and his wife, who is a doctor, decided they would take off in their own plane and do some flight seeing that day. Duncan said they flew about a 60-mile circle, and the weather was extremely variable, from places where the ceiling was 3,000 feet to areas where the rain was beating hard and visibility was extremely reduced. He said the weather patterns were changing rapidly. After they returned to Agulawak and sometime after 6 p.m., he was told that a call to the fish camp to see when the fishing party would return for dinner revealed that they had never arrived. He said they called local air services to start looking for them. His wife grabbed her medical supplies and they went up also. A Bristol Bay pilot radioed to tell Duncan to fly to the south of the main flight path as he was flying alongside the north side.
We sidestepped several miles south of the route to continue the search on the way to the Nooshagak River. 3 minutes later, he called and said, I got him. He gave us the coordinates. We were the second airplane on site. And we called into Dillingham Flight Service with the coordinates. Tom Tucker from Tucker Air, who had been in the air in a helicopter after we called Dillingham with one of our Dillingham employees, Bob Hemschute, also heard the coordinates, and they got very quickly to the site. Tom landed and let several hundred yards above the site. Bob Hemschute got off and started to make his way down to the site. My wife saw a survivor wave and she said, I gotta get on the ground. We landed in Alegnikik and I unloaded her and the gear from my plane. She got into the helicopter. She flew up to the site and joined Bob, and later Tom made another run and brought in some paramedics from Dillingham who were the people who spent the night on the ground. I returned to the site for 40 minutes or so, attempting to act as a radio relay between the site and Dillingham Radio. Stayed on site as long as I could. The weather started to come down fast and hard about 30 to 40 minutes later, and I was forced to leave the site and head into Dillingham. I spent the night in Dillingham attempting to coordinate the rescue coordination efforts. I should make note of our thanks and everyone's thanks for the stellar response from both the state of Alaska and the United States military. My first call when I landed was to Governor Parnell to tell him what had happened. He immediately put all of the resources of the state to help us. The Guard and General Kuznos dispatched several C-130s and several PAVOC helicopters, and the Air Force was instrumental in supporting the rescue. We had the Coast Guard come up with another helicopter. It was not until 7 o'clock the next morning that one of the helicopters was finally able to reach the site in absolutely horrendous weather conditions, and we didn't know who the survivors were and who the victims were until it was radioed in from the site after the second set of survivors had been loaded on. Then they called us and told us who was alive and who was dead.
So you said that these were close friends. Was this an annual event? Did the same group come out every year? Or just tell me a little bit about that history.
We've probably fished with Senator Stevens 18 of the last 20 years. It wasn't always the same group. Many of the people were the same. Bill Phillips was almost always part of the group. And Bill, who, after he left the senator's office, worked as one of our most instrumental representatives in D.C., frequently came up independently of the senator to fish with us. The senator, and maybe it's more 15 of the last 20 years, there were a couple of years in there where the Senate rules got too restrictive and Ted couldn't join us for this, that, or the other reason. But during the periods when he was allowed to do so, he always brought an interesting cadre of people. Early on, before the rules got too restrictive, we had FCC chairman and others up there, and it was part of Ted's annual mission to bring people from D.C. to Alaska to understand what Alaska was always about.
Terry Smith's role as a pilot, was he a contract pilot? Did he work for you? How did it come to be that he was flying this plane?
Terry has worked on and off for the last 20 years as a contract pilot for us. When we first started fishing in rural Alaska, Terry flew his 185 in support of a number of our trips. He's flown with us in his Albatross a number of times. We lost our primary pilot. He quit unexpectedly early in the summer this year, and because it's difficult to find an appropriate quality replacement in the middle of the year, we elected to go with a series of contract pilots for the rest of the summer, people that we knew and had high confidence in that would be available for a couple of weeks at a time, but couldn't afford to commit the whole summer. And Terry had offered to come fly with us. We had the utmost confidence and faith in Terry, and obviously had flown with him many times. He had come back out after his son-in-law's death. He wanted to get away from Anchorage and away from it all. The thing Terry loved most in the world was flying, and he wanted to get away from the pain of his own personal loss and get out and fly, and he was happy to be out there.
Had he flown this particular plane in the past?
He'd had a number of hours in Otters, not as many as in the other airplanes, but he had lots of time in Beavers and lots of time in Turbine Beavers, and I don't know, it was thousands and thousands of hours of amphibious float time. I have no question that Terry was qualified in both the airplane and the area. Terry's the consummate bush pilot. He was incredibly careful, and I just cannot believe that anything will indicate that it was because he didn't know the airplane or anything like that. This isn't that kind of a crash.
Talk a little bit about Dana and her role. She was with the company for more than two decades, went through something known as the telephone wars. Can you talk a little about her role in that and how significant her work was to help the company be successful?
Dana started as an economic analyst in our regulatory department more than 20 years ago. She used to get angry when I said how much more, but recently she'd begun to accept the fact that she was no longer 21. She progressed very rapidly when the attorney who was running that department left 15, 16 years ago. She became the head of that department and continued to rise. She had good political instincts. Her training, her undergraduate training, was in economics, and she understood the core issues involved, and she was a very tenacious fighter. She believed fervently in the benefits of competition. It aligned perfectly with her academic training, and she was almost religious about the benefits of competition as opposed to monopolies. Dana was at her finest when she was at the middle of a regulatory firefight, and people underestimated her at their peril in those events. So most of our regulatory victories she was either instrumental in or the architect of, and in the last 5 to 10 years she had really driven the entirety of the regulatory policy. I didn't have to worry about what was happening there. She'd create the strategy and she'd carry it out successfully.
Well, my last question would be, you've got employees around the state and you've said several times that you're like a family. What do you want to say to them now?
Well, first of all, I want to thank them for their incredible support. The employees from Dillingham just pitched right in like I would expect that they would, but Bob Himshute climbing up there on the mountain in the middle of the night, sliding down the steep slope, getting so soaked he was almost hypothermic, and not thinking about himself. That's the kind of response I've come to expect from GCI. For the rest of the employees, as we go through this, I appreciate their support, and we need to know that we're all there for each other. The company will continue to go on and do good things. It will always have a large scar from a very painful wound that it's experienced, but it's not going to change who we are or the way we do business or the things we accomplish.
Ron Duncan is the president and CEO of GCI. Today's entire 20-minute interview is on our website, aprn.org. Duncan said a memorial service for Dana Tyndall is scheduled for 4 p.m. Monday at the Dena'ina Convention Center in Anchorage. The state's medical examiner, Catherine Raven, said the five victims of Monday's crash likely died soon after impact. Greg Wilkinson, a spokesman for the State Department of Health and Social Services, says privacy requirements prevent additional comment.
The state medical examiner's office was able to complete all five autopsies on Wednesday. Initial results of the autopsy, and we can't go into detail about individual injuries, but suffice to say that all five people died from blunt force trauma, from injuries that would be consistent with this type of a plane crash.
Four people, including former NASA Chief Sean O'Keefe, survived. According to a spokeswoman at Providence Alaska Medical Center, where the four were taken, O'Keefe's conditions have improved from critical to serious. O'Keefe's son Kevin remains in fair condition. Jim Morehard also remains in fair condition. And William Willie Phillips Jr. is in good condition. The cause of the crash is not yet known. NTSB is investigating. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a $300,000 fine against Alaskans for Clean Government.
Our position was that we didn't need to register as a group because we weren't running the ballot campaign.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission has levied a penalty of nearly $340,000 against Alaskans for Open Government. According to the commission, the group failed to meet the APOC reporting requirements in a timely fashion. KSKA's Len Anderson has more.
In the three-page letter dated August 5th, the Public Offices Commission cited tardy contribution acknowledgments dating back to May 2008. The last entry from a list of 21 was made on June 17th of this year. Alaskans for Open Government is a group that received contributions from various sources, many from outside the state, and passed them on to Clean Team Alaska. That's the group who promoted the initiative which became Ballot Measure 1 on the August 24th ballot. Proponents describe Measure 1 as an anti-corruption law. Opponents say it's a wide-reaching proposal that stifles political participation. APOC's executive director, Holly Hill, said policy forbids staff from discussing an unresolved case in the media. She referred any inquiries to the letter itself. Attorney Ken Jacobus is one of the deputy treasurers of Alaskans for Open Government. He says the situation began when APOC demanded that Open Government register as a political group.
Our position was that we didn't need to register as a group because we weren't running the ballot campaign. All that we were doing was providing some assistance to clean elections and, you know, other things too.
Jacoba says Alaskans for Open Government did register. The APOC letter dates that registration as June 2nd, 2010.
We don't want to hide anything. We're going to disclose all the money. We're going to disclose the donors. Even though we're not required to, we're going to do it. So the next thing that happened is they fined us for failure to register, which would be $33,200.
After the registration, slightly later filings included contributions made to Open Government and passed through to the initiative and subsequently the ballot measure group. That information was filed June 28, 2010, and covered a two-year period. According to the APOC letter, the group had always been required to file a contribution list. Therefore, the 21 contributions were 5,500 combined days late. The maximum penalty was $50 a day for a total of $276,600. APOC's letter also states that as a group required to have registered prior to August 7, 2008, Alaskans for Open Government failed to file in a timely fashion two required year-end reports. That penalty, just under $30,000, raising the combined total to just about $340,000. Jacoba says because Clean Team Alaska listed the contributors and stated that the money came through Alaskans for Open Government, his group didn't feel that they had to file. He added, once contributors knew that they would be identified through Alaskans for Open Government, the money dried up.
We knew the next step was going to be that if they say that we have to register, then they're going to say that the persons who donated money to AOG would have to identify themselves. And they were not Alaskans. And they knew that if they identified themselves and put their names before APOC, that APOC would come down on them.
According to Jacobus, a major contributor up to that point was Americans for Limited Government, a libertarian organization funded and run by New York real estate developer Howie Rich. Alaskans for Open Government will appeal the penalty.
What APOC does when it fines somebody like this, it normally in the letters lists the maximum fine, with or without the intent of actually imposing it. Now, I've talked to them about this. I've looked at the mitigation criteria, and we will be filing an appeal so that the matter can be actually considered by the Public Offices Commission itself. This letter came from the staff of the commission.
Jacoba says that appeal before the commission will not take place until after the August election. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Matt Nuska, Susitna Borough officials say construction projects in the area have created 70 new jobs this summer. The projects are related to the Port McKenzie expansion. A barge dock there is growing from 8 to 16 acres. The $5 million barge dock expansion makes it an ideal area for large industrial projects, according to Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan. Construction of a one-mile rail loop that will be able to handle a 100-car train has helped to boost employment numbers also. The related projects are expected to make Port McKenzie the only place in the state where the Alaska Railroad can offload bulk materials in an efficient loop.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
For years, the Aleutian village of Accutan has seen the energy potential in its hot springs and fumaroles. Now it looks like that potential might be realized. In July, work began on two exploratory wells. The first one was drilled on July 16th, and it's producing hot water at more than 360 degrees. The exploration team is drilling a second well, and they're optimistic that the water will be similarly warm. If it is, the exploration phase will end, and the city of Accutan will start working on a power plant that would harness the steam from the ground and use it to power electrical turbines. Ray Mann is Accutan's project manager, and he's been working closely on the exploration project. He explains that Accutan, with its hot water at shallow depths, is particularly well suited for a renewable energy project like this.
Obviously, they've lived with this resource, for thousands of years out here, and the fact that there's flowing hot springs out in the valley, and there's steam vents and fumaroles there on the volcano. I mean, everyone knows that there's a heat source there, and it's always been a hope, like any community that's positioned that way, that we could tap into that, and particularly now with the cost of diesel fuel and looking into the future of energy costs.
There are plenty of other places in Alaska that have geothermal potential. In Unalaska, the presence of the Makushin volcano means that a similar project would be possible. But no place is as far along with its exploration work as Accutan.
We could be the first if we can get our power plant online, and we hope by 2012. We could be the first village to go completely onto renewable energy and into heating for residential heating in Alaska.
The exploration team hopes to have a power plant online by 2012. Southeast troll fishermen have had a better-than-average year. Coho are coming in fatter at the start of the season than they were at the end of last year's run. Prices are looking up, and chums add variety to the catch. From Petersburg, KFSK's Melody Kay walked the docks and caught up with some longtime fishermen to find out more.
There's one right over there.
Great. So I'm going for more coffee.
Norman Cheney, Wes Abbott, and John Steffen have been trolling out of Petersburg for 30 to 40 years apiece. The three are taking advantage of an early August fishery closure and a rare sunny southeast afternoon to catch up dockside in North Harbor. Steffen says he mostly fishes where Abbott goes, but as they discuss the season, each man's fortune sounds uniquely his own.
Well, I've had about a 7-pound average on the last couple loads that I've brought in. I had one load that was 8.2, but it's been, you know, pretty nice fish this year.
That's Cheney. He says the coho he hauled in this year are much larger than in previous years, especially compared to last year's lean 6-pound silvers. The troll fleet has been fishing for coho and even chum salmon in various parts of the region this summer since an 8-day opening for king salmon in early July. The fishery closes for several days in August every year to allow silvers to return to the inside waters of Southeast. For Abbott, fishing this summer has been mediocre, but he says the fish size and the price help.
Getting about a 7-pound average, and then the price is up a little more too, so that makes it better.
Stefan hasn't been as fortunate.
I don't really want to even talk about it. Mine's been so bad.
But Abbott says Stefan is hiding how well he's doing. Alaskan Department of Fish and Game numbers show Southeast trollers having not just a better overall fish per boat landing, but catching more coho compared to the 20-year average. Southeast Yakutat troll management biologist Patty Scannis says that overall coho catches started off low, but the fishery saw 3 weeks of above-average hauls. Catch rates tapered off a little in early August, coming closer to the average. Scannis adds that the fish have been larger than last year, though there are too many variables to guess why.
It's hard to say just what influences the run as a whole because it's made up of so many different individual stocks.
Scannis says there are 880 trollers fishing in the Southeast and Yakutat area this year. Effort in the first king salmon opening in July saw a big drop from last year, with 90 fewer boats fishing. She thinks openings in Washington, Oregon, and California might have dissuaded visiting trollers. She also notes some trollers opted to chase hatchery chum salmon, returning to Neats Bay, 40 miles north of Ketchikan, instead of Kings. With chum coming for an average of 72 cents a pound, coho $1.37, and chinook averaging $3.37 a pound, trollers had more options this year. Early in the season, Scannis says 40 boats tried their luck catching chum near home shore in icy straits. There were also 85 boats in Neats Bay. And during the August coho closure, there have been some fishing on chum returning to the Medviji hatchery near Sitka. Interest in trolling for chums is still relatively low, though, and Abbott says he prefers to stay closer to home.
I just usually just fish pretty much the same areas, and then if it gets nasty, I know where to hide.
Cheney agrees. He says he'll leave chum fishing to the younger fishermen.
Well, some of them went for them, but I don't fish for them myself.
Why?
Well, I'm busy doing other things, and that's too much work for an old man like me.
You're doing it next year?
Oh, yeah. I'll probably do until the good Lord calls me. I have nothing else to do but fish.
The fleet has another chance to catch kings starting August 15th. In the last summer opening, the catch totaled 74,500 kings. That leaves 33,600 to be harvested in the second opening, expected to last 6 to 7 days. Catch monitoring will be done in season, and the fishery will be closed on short notice when the quota has been reached. Standing dockside in Petersburg, this is Melody Kay.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Melody Kay in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free. And it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.